football fans, it's now time for the D3Football.com Around the Nation podcast. Here are your hosts, Pat Coleman and Keith McMillan.
And welcome to our Week 4 preview podcast. I'm Pat Coleman of D3Football.com, and this one is where my podcast partner, Keith McMillan, and I get together to take a quick look at the games coming up this weekend. And this weekend, we have a big game for the number one team, a pretty big game for team number two, a game that's big for number six. And while there are multiple entire conferences which have the weekend off, every time I feel like it might not be a great weekend of games, some unexpected contest comes up and surprises us.
My thought exactly, Pat. Sometimes the weeks that look the weakest, and make no mistake, when the top 25 opponents are North Park, Teal, Kenyon, Howard Payne, UW-Eau Claire, Carleton, we're not expecting a bunch of overtimes or upsets. But sometimes those weeks that look the weakest turn out to be the most fun. Week 3 is a hard act to follow. Believe it or not, it's week 4 already. And while we might not have 3 overtimes, 91-61, games move to Wednesday or what have you, when you play close to 100 games in a weekend, you're going to have some drama. And we're really leaning into some key early conference games now.
Indeed, this is one of those years where we have 5 weekends in September. Here on this 21st day of September. So we're going to get to October and already be basically done with half of the regular season. One big game on the schedule this weekend is a game that has been played in November in recent years. We'll get an earlier look at it this time around when number 15 John Carroll plays at top-ranked Mount Union.
Yeah, and I believe it's a big test for Mount Union when I see it. But part of the reason why the Purple Raiders are so successful is because they convince themselves that every week, and especially John Carroll week, it's a big test. And look, most of the past 5 years in this game have been. Even though the Purple Raiders have won all but one have been a one-score game. Mark Podolsky of the News Herald listed all the results in his preview this week. It was 2013, Mount Union won 42-34. Then in the 2014 regular season, it was 31-24 and 36-28 in the playoffs. Both of those Mount Union wins. 2015 was the blowout in this recent part of the series, 36-3. Then 2016 was the one John Carroll won, 31-28. They snapped the string of OAC conference wins for Mount Union, and they were the champion. They went in and went all the way to the semifinals that year. Last year, it didn't look like it should be a good game, but it was a 31-27 Mount Union win. We'll get to some X's and O's a little later, but it's probably the game this week that will tell us the most about what we can expect from the national champions and the rest of the OAC this season.
Yeah, that take of I'll believe it's a big test when I see it has definitely been validated a lot in a lot of games for Mount Union in the past 20 seasons. I'm of mixed feelings about where this is on the schedule. It was a great showdown in week 11, obviously, last couple years. But when there were years that neither team had any other tests, it was a real long time to wait to learn how good Mount Union was or how good John Carroll was. Now, on the flip side, I think week 4 is earlier than I'd like it, but the OAC doesn't really consult me when it makes its master schedule.
I'm a huge fan of having that week 11 game be a rivalry game, obviously coming from where I came from. It gives you something to look forward to if your season goes off the rails. It gives you something to look forward to if you're having an undefeated season. So no matter how you slice it, it's always the biggest game. But to call this is the closest thing Mount Union has to a rivalry, but it's a game where they've lost 3 times in the past 30 or whatever the series record is, like 32-3-1 or something like that. So it's not – Mount Union really is incapable of having a rival, as much as this is their local rivalry. So I don't know if it matters when it's played. It's close enough, you know, between Alliance and Cleveland where people from both sides will be recruited to both teams. People from both sides can drive to either location. So in that sense, it is a rivalry, and it doesn't matter which week you play it. It's probably the biggest regular season game for Mount Union, and it's the game that tells us, is John Carroll going to be for real this year or not so much?
You know, I used to think that the Tommy Johnny game, for example, should only ever be played in week 11, but I've reconsidered that because of the weather in Minnesota. I just basically want that game to always draw the maximum number of fans that it can, so I'm just fine with it being in week 7 for the next couple of years. Keith, as an aside, if the MIAC's new weather policy had been in place last year, they wouldn't have played that Target Field game, at least not at its scheduled 1 o'clock kickoff.
Well, I'm glad we can avoid that scenario.
That would have been a bad look in front of 37,000 people. Mm-hmm. We talked about number 2 having a big game. That's Mary Hardin-Baylor. Of course, tumultuous offseason there. Lots of changes. Coach Pete Fredenberg, has been serving a suspension for the first 3 weeks of the season. He's not been on the sidelines or with his team in these first 2 games. And the last one of those 3 is this weekend against Texas Lutheran.
And it's a big game in the sense that TLU comes in 2-0. And they've given Mary Hardin-Baylor some some tough games over the years. But at the same time, it doesn't look like Mary Harden Baylor struggled really at all with Coach Fredenberg out. 91-7 at Albright, 68-7 last week at Sol Ross. The level of competition will jump up a little bit, and this is the third straight road game in a row for them. But I think the main thing is to get this game played, to keep the momentum going. We talked to Coach Harmon.
Yeah, Larry Harmon. Yep.
Talked to Coach Harmon after the Albright game, and he was, even though it was 91-7, he was a little bit disappointed with how the defense tackled. So Mary Harden Baylor keeping its eyes on the process and trying to get better rather than the final score. And I think that'll be a little bit of the same this week because they got Southwestern and then Harden-Simmons coming up. And that's the game where you know, they really want to be back at full strength, have Coach Fredenberg comfortable, and have everything running the way they normally would want it.
Sixth-ranked Frostburg State is the other team we mentioned a couple of moments ago. We'll talk about this a little bit later too, but they've had, of course, an extra week off. They are actively recruiting a team for September 20th. They're actively recruiting Hobart. Hobart's interesting because they have just 9 games and the campus's homecoming is September 29th and they do not have a football game. I'm not sure that that's enough to get them to play Frostburg because it's not really the way that Hobart is scheduled over the past few years, but that would be hilarious / awesome if that game got scheduled.
Yeah, I'd love to see teams be able to fill in that open dates on the schedule. I've never been a big fan of the 9 games, and you know, just as a player, as a coach, as a competitor, you always want to compete as many times as you can. And in most cases, you want to play the best competition that you can, especially if it doesn't affect your conference standing or your chance of getting into the playoffs. It's just a game that can get you tightened up, a chance to measure where you stand nationally, and then, you know, it's still have that avenue to win your conference and get into the postseason.
We had an interesting story on the website this week, which is about the Zach Field at Washington and Jefferson. You know, W&J is one of those teams that's playing one of the teams that you mentioned that's probably not going to provide us a classic football game this weekend. But I thought it was really interesting when I think I and Joe Sager kind of independently discovered that that W&J has 4 players in the secondary all named Zach. Zach Quattrone, Zach Queen, Zach Roiba, and Zach Taylor.
And you're always looking for reasons for your guys to bond and you know, give themselves a nickname and feel like they're a group at each position group. Then you want your whole defense to bond, and then of course you want your whole team to bond and your community too. So like you're looking for these ways, and it's nice when it's something, even though it's kind of arbitrary. It's nice when you have something built in right away, and that's a pretty good feature. You should read it. And as another aside, I'm fascinated with names, and we have some great ones in D3. So at some point this year, either on the podcast or online, we'll get to our favorite names.
I really enjoy the fact that the fourth of those guys is the one sophomore. That Zach Taylor, if you look at you know, his full name is Zachary Taylor. So if he were just there alone, which he will be next year, you could talk about the presidents having a president in the secondary.
Yeah, I saw that one coming.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I fairly telegraphed it. Also on the website this week, I would check in with Adam Turr's Around the Nation column. He talks about first of all, the rookie head coaches at WNL, at Western New England, and Thomas Moore. These are all young guys who are coaching their alma mater. And he also references young coaches at Louisiana College in Maryville who are not in their first year as head coach, but recently became head coaches of their alma mater as well. Without getting into the nitty-gritty of this story, because I would definitely recommend you go to the website to read it. Keith, this is something that we've talked about, that Division III across the board, regardless of sport, is a place where you really have a lot of guys who come back to coach their alma mater, and sometimes that they stay then for decades and finish off their career that way.
Yeah, especially in the programs where you either have a winning tradition and you want to keep that tradition intact, or you have a place where winning is not necessarily the only priority, right? Priority is also recruiting a certain profile of student, having that student go through the school and graduate. And so you want someone who's not confused necessarily by the challenges of finding a certain kind of kid, making sure that kid can get through 4 years and finish, and also has those relationships with the alumni and with the local high schools, because recruiting is always your lifeblood. Alumni, colleges rely on it so much. The smaller the college, the more they rely on that alumni. So anytime you can find a guy who you know is a good coach, right, you're not rolling the dice because you've seen him in your program, either as a player or as an assistant some way. You're not rolling the dice. They have those relationships. It's always a great match. And one of my favorite things about writing the Around the Nation column, which I did from 2001 to 13, was finding those common threads between programs across the country. D3, now that it's at 250 schools, and it'll always be coast to coast, from Maine to Southern California, from Pacific Northwest down to Georgia, and everywhere in between, it's still amazing that within that group of 250, there will always be some ties that bind all of us.
We talked in our Monday podcast about what a bad start to the season it was for Kane. In this edition, we'll talk to their coach, Dan Garrett, about the team's early season struggles, facing all that option offense, and then how to get their own offense on track when it has nobody back from last season. That's coming up in a minute. But I'd like to take this time to talk about a book that I've been reading, and I'm continuing to read it because, you know, I have like 75,000 things to do, so I can read a couple chapters a night of this book, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL by author Jeff Perlman. It is a fantastic look at the USFL. If you don't know what the USFL is, say you're maybe younger than 30 when this league was up and down in the early to mid-1980s. It's a fascinating look at, you know, the building of this league, which was built, of course, as a rival to the NFL, or if nothing else, a chance to offer football in the spring, which, you know, is not a thing that currently happens anymore, obviously, at the professional level. So I really enjoyed reading it, and there's just amazing insider stories and background stories about how these teams were built and, you know, how the whole league came together. One of the key people, of course, in the USFL is a D3 guy. That's Sam Mills, who is a linebacker at Montclair State. He plays for the Philadelphia team, and the Philadelphia Stars made him into a star. He made himself into a star with Philadelphia. It's just a lot of fun to read about the USFL. Even if you don't care about the D3 connection, I would definitely recommend you pick it up. You can order it off Amazon.com, for example. You can order it off links on our website. And if you do that, we'll get our almost a buck. I think it's like 88 cents. If you click on the link and purchase the book, if you're going to buy it anyway, because you're a football fan, buy it through our link. That's all I'm saying. Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL by Jeff Perlman. Now on the D3Football.com Around the Nation podcast, we're joined by Dan Garrett, the 13th-year head coach at Kane University. Coming off a couple of struggles in the first couple of weeks, 42-0 loss to Springfield, 28-0 loss to Salisbury. Coach, I just thought I'd get that on the record right at the top of the conversation.
That's okay. I think I would like to get that out of the way early anyway.
Well, if nothing else, I guess you got those two games out of the way early. One of the things that Keith and I are always interested in, and we talk fairly frequently on this podcast about, is, you know, the triple option offense. And obviously, you know, it is not the same the way Springfield runs it versus the way Salisbury runs it. Salisbury is not even really, they have some of the same principles, but they throw the ball so much more than they used to. But was there any... Did you have any benefit from like a game prep standpoint facing these two teams back to back at the beginning of the year?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point. And I think the first point is the only reason we even want to play a Springfield is because Salisbury's in our conference and Salisbury's our week two game. But they are drastically different in a lot of different ways. Yeah. Springfield presents a lot of different unbalanced formations. They widen their reads. They change who has what, as opposed to what Salisbury does in their what I'll call the Navy triple option spread offense, where there's not nearly as many variables as what Springfield offers you. So really doing that, we wanted to get the game speed ready for our week one game against Salisbury, which is our conference. So that's the nuts and bolts as to the why. You know, the first thing I would think is we do get game acclimated from our defensive vantage point after seeing any triple option team, even as drastically different as Salisbury is versus Springfield. We get our defensive guys ready to how fast that pitch is going to come on the edge or how fast that ball is going to pop out from the fullback. And that really was the whole genesis as to why let's play a Springfield in week one.
And I do think we've heard that a lot, you know, from the coaches who are either in a position to schedule them or the coaches who run those offenses, who say that, you know, it's really difficult for them to go out and find someone who's willing to prepare and spend 1 week just on this, on something that they might not use the rest of the year.
Yeah, and it is. Initially when we first started this, Pat, we had Southern Virginia in our conference too, and they're still here, and they ran the triple. And so we had week one in our conference play, Salisbury. Week two in our conference play in the block schedule was Southern Virginia. So when Springfield had an opportunity to come on our schedule, you know, it was almost kind of a no-brainer from the vantage point. All right, well, we're going to have all off-season to get ready for triple. Let's get a non-conference game in a triple and spend 9 months preparing to do it. And obviously, we've gotten better at it. But if you don't execute and you do undisciplined things or you have undisciplined in your penalties, a team like Springfield and or Salisbury, it's going to happen drastically quick when they get you.
What's the balance of time that you might spend then either in spring ball or in your preseason camp getting ready for what you're going to see the first couple of weeks versus, you know, something a more standard, whatever your regular defense would be?
We really do have, we're an even front team in our regular defense, and we played a triple. We've been playing a triple with an Okie front or a 3-4 type of mentality since I've been a defensive coach. So we'll spend a week on our option defense in the spring, and the more finite is preseason. Like last year when we did this, we spent initially installing our initial defense, our four down front early, and as we got out of the week, you know, week one, week and a half into camp, then we started focusing on our option defense. And now, when you're done with the option, now it's like you don't have to reinstall your base defense, but you dang sure got to go over it again because you ain't played base defense except going in practice against us in specific segments through 2 weeks to get our defense to still play regular defense.
And preseason, of course, over the last couple of years has been shortened. It's been changed just because of the whole restrictions around practices and two-a-days and numbers of practices and that sort of thing. Do you feel like the kids, first of all, not even talking about, you know, being ready with your offensive package or your defensive package or your option defensive package, are the kids just ready to go basically after that short of camp?
Here's my opinion on this, and I don't know how many football coaches either agree or disagree, but I know this from a Division III standpoint, we don't have them with us all summer. And when they come back to camp, you know, we are basically crossing our fingers and praying that they did what they were supposed to do as 21, 20, 19-year-olds all summer long. So when you only have 15 practices going into a game week before you got to play, in my opinion, I don't think it's nearly long enough, especially when you cut off the number of practices to prepare them physically, let alone mentally, to be ready to play a football game after only having 15 practices. And then when you add the heat into it, like this summer, you know, we were limited a lot because, you know, the heat index a couple of days was in the high 90s. And our trainers and us, we were smart about what we wanted to do. And I made a running joke in camp, guys, to the football team. Hey, according to how you guys act with one practice a day in 80-degree weather, I should have died in 1993 because, you know, they're just not physically ready. And we, you know, we emphasize this all the time to our people around here that we really wish that preseason was extended because they're not ready physically after being away from us all summer, which is ultimately 3 months.
All right. At this point, you guys are yet to get on the scoreboard in the first two games. At a glance, it looks like everything needs work. But what are the key areas you guys have been stressing going into your game against Southern Virginia this week?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I used to be a big process guy, and I got away from that for a little bit. But right now, when you have we only had three returning starters back in the offensive unit this year due to graduation, and all three of those guys are now out and injured from the first 2 weeks. So now we're playing with 11 new guys across the board. So I really, truly mean this in the most sincere way because I've never experienced anything quite like this, being shut out in the first two games, and we're not even close. I mean, so we've had some positive plays more so than week one. We really did not execute anything well on the offensive vantage point. Week one. Week two, we executed much better. Week two, we were able to do some things, as crazy as it sounds, being shut out again, but we turned the ball over three times. So when we moved the ball, we had big plays, and we were able to do some things, we shot ourselves in the foot with turnover. So I think right now the message to our guys is really focusing on taking every day and working on get better. And kind of along the lines of the Urban Meyer / you know, Brian and Tim Kite, I need everyone's response. And because you get to choose your response, I need everyone's response to be great. And whether that's great as a starter, a backup guy, a role guy, because their response is an event for everybody around them, and our outcome has to get better. In order to get better outcomes, everybody shares a piece of this thing, and they got to respond every day to make everyone else's event better. And that's at practice, that's at meetings, that's at film room, and hopefully that can transcend into the game day and hopefully get better execution for four quarters or 60 minutes to put points on the board. And right now, the focus on just getting better. And hopefully if everyone takes that approach to choose to have a great response, no matter what their role is, then the event can hopefully be better for everybody else around them.
13 years as the head coach of this program, and there's been some real ups and downs, right? You know, you start off inheriting a program that, you know, especially when you came in as an assistant, was pretty much near the bottom of the NJAC on a fairly regular basis. And then you've got to build them up 7 wins, 9 wins. It slips back to 5, 10, 5, 2, 2, 8, 7, 4. It's all over the board. What's it like kind of, you know, riding that roller coaster from year to year?
Well, it's certainly something that I'm very cognizant of, and I try to do some things every year to try and either tighten up the ship or try something different. And I really try to do what I've called a self-autopsy over the years. You know, how can we get it better here? What do I need to tighten up there? Some years it's discipline. Some years it's, hey, we just lost our best player because mom and dad can't afford school anymore. So, but what I've always tried to do is be super consistent in the sense that I understand the conference that we play in, and in the Northeast with the teams that we've played, most of those years, and I did a study, and I wish I had the numbers in front of me, I did a breakdown of those 12 years. I'll give you last year's alone, because last year we were 4-6, and there was 25 seniors, and we had really high expectation last year, because we came off, like you said, the 8-win and 7-win season with 25 seniors. We lost 6 games. But it came down to 9 plays in this conference, and we lost a 3-point game to Montclair, a 3-point game to Frostburg on the road, a 1-point game to Rowan, and it really came down to 9 plays or 4 losses that were a combined score of 14 points. So to me, it's always been about the razor-thin margin of error, and I think that if we had 27 losses in my 12 years, that were by a combined or score of less of 1 score. So whether, I think the average was like 6.8 points a game over those 27 losses in my first 12 years. So for us, we're there, but you know, we're not at the top echelon because we're not making those plays when it counts. And those things got to get tightened up. And we talk about that. We're not afraid to talk about it here because of the inconsistency. But they also have to understand when you play a Rowan, Montclair, Frostburg, Salisbury, CNU, all these other teams, TCNJ, I mean, everyone on our schedule, the razor thin margin of error, you just don't know when that one play is going to be. So, you know, we really try to get them to focus on the high sense of urgency that every play is important. And for me, I've never let that roller coaster bother me. I take the same approach every year, and I let these guys know in our program when we recruit them, hey, coaches don't make plays. And coaches don't win games, but coaches sure as heck win players. Players are going to make plays, and players are going to win games, but we really try to get the relationship thing here going strong and get them to understand that the things they have to buy into is what we preach. And what we preach, you know, we preach a lot about the family, and no matter what you're going through, we need to have a great response to the adversity around us. And when adversity is at its worst, we need our best response. And right now, I'm banking on the only 12 seniors we have this year, but I'm banking on those guys to be the rallying board to have great responses, because our team needs that response from everybody right now with the adversity we're facing.
How often do you hear the name of your school mispronounced?
Well, for the first 2 years, I think I mispronounced it wrong for 2 years till the vice president corrected me. So it's off more often than not do people say Keene, and it's Kane, K-A-N-E, the pronunciation, but it's spelled K-E-A-N. So more often than not, hey, how's Keene University doing? And it is Kane. So, yeah, Pat, you got one there. There's no doubt it's a Keene more than Kane.
Pronunciation 101.
Buena Vista.
Mona Bell.
Buena Vista.
Muhlenberg.
Gallardi.
German Aereo.
Kane.
Yeah, that's how you pronounce Kane.
Well, if you're like us and you're fascinated by the nuts and bolts of why these games came together, how a team prepares for them, that was a great interview. I think it also showed that the appeal of coaching is far beyond winning. It's about the process. It's about building relationships with the young men in your program. It's about finding your why to find your how, accountability. Lots of good stuff in there. One thing I would have liked to hear more about was how you deal with the psychology of not just being 0-2, but not having scored. I think about the team psychology so much. I remember thinking about it as a player, even though I was never a captain. You want to have your finger on the pulse of your teammates, speak up when needed, shut up and lead by example when needed. And I feel like that's something, I don't know how much time coaches spend on team psychology, but I imagine it's a lot, and I imagine it varies from program to program. Coach Garrett also touched on an important thing. Your response is most of what you can control. And then it goes back, crazy as it sounds, to not having to coach effort, which we referenced in the Monday podcast. But when you're 0-2, you haven't scored, you can't go back and fix those things. But what you can do is control your response from here on out. And I feel like for a coach, especially if your dreams already for the season are a little bit dashed, you can't win the next 8 games. You can only just win, you know, work on this 1 week. And when you realize, as Coach Garrett does, that his offense has a long way to go, the response is step one. I thought there were a couple other neat things in the interview. It reminded me of playing the Gettysburg Wing T, which not the same as triple option, but similar in terms of prep, where we would have that game at Randolph-Macon. We had that game, I think, week five. So you play your games against, and then you come in for that week, and everything you've done to date, just scrap, put it to the side. We'll get back to it in week six. But this week, we have to learn this defensive scheme. And so the first time we played Gettysburg, we lost 27-23. Felt like we had a lot more talent than them. We let a touchdown, a fullback, go right up the middle. Somebody missed an assignment on it, and a fullback ran like a 60-yard touchdown right up the middle, and that cost us the game. Next year, we got it figured out. We schemed it. It was the year I remember. I feel like part of my job as cornerback that year was to take on pulling guard to keep the outside linebacker free to tackle. So I got crushed that game. But we won 27-0. The next year we won 44-13. So once you figure out how to practice against and play against a triple option or wing T or whatever, it can be stopped. But what Coach Garrett was talking about is very important, because you sort of have to compartmentalize everything that you practice and then move that compartment over. And so he was trying to be smart about it and put all the triple option stuff early in the season. And sometimes even that doesn't help. Mm-hmm. One last thing that cracked me up that he said, the I should have died in 1993 joke. Not to go all old guy on you, but we didn't have spring practice back when I played, and I finished in 97, graduated in 98. But we alternated two-a-days and three-a-days during preseason camp. So we may maybe have like a 6 or 8 a.m. practice. You'd have a noon special teams walk through, and then a 6 p.m. practice. And that was how we beat the heat, right? We didn't do anything really strenuous in the middle of the day. You do it super early, super late. But there was also no time to get into trouble or any kind of anything, because all you were doing the entire time for like 15 days was eating or sleeping. The big difference is we had 15 days, but we weren't limited to 15 practices. So we're getting, you know, 30 practices in there, plus special teams walkthrough means you don't have to spend practice time on that in the morning or that evening. We certainly were probably more ready to play, even though we didn't have spring ball either.
Yeah, and of course, Dan Garrett is about the same age as you are. He's a 1997 grad of Montclair State. If I'd had more time with him, we'd talk about, you know, playing for Coach Giancola and facing him every year in that conference. And of course, you know, right now, Rick Giancola is the dean of Division III coaches. He's the winningest head coach active in Division III football. He's been coaching there for 36 years. There were definitely, with a lot of these interviews, there's a lot more that we could talk about. And this was the 10 and a half minutes or so that we ended up with. Moving on to our six games to watch. Keith and I will be talking about six games from this weekend in some detail. And we got to start with the one that's the big one. That's, of course, we've already mentioned that it exists, but it's 15th ranked John Carroll at top ranked Mountain Union. And Keith, last year, John Carroll came into this game at 6-3. I don't think we necessarily expected much of their chances, but then the Blue Streaks had a possession at the end with a chance to win the game. I think John Carroll is better this year, but with the game being an alliance, I'm not sure that the game will be as competitive as last year's was.
Well, pretty similar to my comments from last week about Baldwin Wallace. If you want to be taken seriously nationally, you have to show well here. And with a 45-21 win at Wisconsin Stevens Point to start, and then a 45-0 home win against Otterbein last week, John Carroll certainly looks above average so far this season, but let's see if it's elite. I think it starts with either trying to make the Mount Union offense one-dimensional by limiting the run game, or being the rare team that gets pressure on a Purple Raiders quarterback. You give Fulford time and Hill, Ruth, Luke Harrington, they're just going to carve you up. I think they have to get Mount Union down from their team-wide 6.6 yards per carry to under 4. They have to limit big plays, get some turnovers. And they got to get something big from Ray Brown and the rest of that John Carroll defense.
Let's throw it out to Adam Turr.
We're only 3 weeks in, but there are some programs who can solidify their trajectory just by continuing their fast start to the season. St. Olaf appears to be a program solidly rebuilding. With a 4-0 start, second-year head coach James Killian will be well within his rights to toot his own Vatirgenflurgen. The Olies won a total of 6 games from 2013 through 2016. In Killian's first year at the helm last season, St. Olaf won 4 games, including 3 in the MIAC, equaling its conference victories from the previous 4 seasons combined. A 2-0 start to conference play will keep fans excited. The schedule is backloaded, but the Olies aren't concerned about looking ahead. Ricardo Johnson III appears to have found his home after leaving Ohio Northern for the seemingly greener pastures of Division II. He has rushed for 4 touchdowns and passed for 10 to lead the Olies to 3 straight victories. Augsburg eked out a pair of three-point victories in non-conference play, but has St. John's and St. Thomas coming up in the next 2 weeks. A loss at St. Olaf will likely lead to an 0-4 start in MIAC play. The Auggies want to reverse their recent backslide since a 500 campaign in 2015. The Olies want to continue their rise in the Killian era. This is one of those games featuring two teams desperate to stay in the middle of the pack in a top-heavy conference. The high temperature in Northfield, Minnesota is projected to be 65 degrees on Saturday, so the 1 p.m. local kickoff time will remain after last week's wet bulb temps forced the MIAC to get wacky with its Saturday slate. Pat and Keith, back to you.
Thanks, Adam. Now let's send it out to Frank Rossi.
From In the Huddle and D3Football.com, I'm Frank Rossi. This week, I'm excited to preview a game that we've all had circled on our calendar since the preseason. No, I'm not talking about Rowan Frostburg State. I'm talking about Lycoming at FDU Florham, of course. Well, maybe that's a stretch, but what isn't a stretch is the importance of this game for two teams that right now have a legitimate chance to shake up the MAC title race. It's been 30 years since FDU Florham started a season at 4-0, and one of the keys to their 2018 success has been the maturity of senior quarterback Jagger Green this season. Green's been around the Devils program since 2014, but he took 2015 off to get a better grasp on his future. Green's 12 touchdowns against just two interceptions this year have powered the offense to a 3-0 start overall and a 1-0 start in the MAC. Yet the even bigger difference maker in 2018 appears to be the FDU defense. After giving up an average of 39 points per game in 2017, the Devils' defense has given up just 17 points per game in their first three games of this season. Some note, though, the schedule has been favorable for FDU Florham, but a real test comes Saturday as Lycoming comes into town on a two-game winning streak. Despite Lycoming's 2-1 record this season, their offense has failed to grab many accolades, with quarterback Elijah Shemery passing for just three touchdowns against five interceptions, and with the offense averaging less than 300 yards per game. Like the Devils, the Warriors have been leaning on their defense to set the tone, with 19 tackles for loss, including 10 sacks being registered in their three games. With the new MAC structure of just 8 conference games for each team, a 2-0 start for one of these teams means a real chance to influence or even win the conference race. In the case of Lycoming, traditional forces Widener and Albright will not play MAC conference games against them this year. In the case of FDU Florham, though, Kings and frontrunner Delaware Valley are missing. But before we dissect the MAC tiebreakers in such a situation, the Devils need to get through Lycoming by protecting Jagger Green better than Lycoming's prior 2018 opponents protected their quarterbacks. Otherwise, Lycoming's defense will do damage in the Devils' backfield early and often to try to move to 3-1 for their best start since 2014. Mr. Coleman and Mr. McMillan, back to you.
Well, thanks for the formalities there, Frank. Keith, we could talk about this game just a little bit really briefly, too. It is quite a surprise that Lyco and FDU Florham become such a key game in this conference race. But I really do think that this is the way the games are shaking out here just in the first 3 weeks of the season for the MAC, that we're looking at a MAC winner that's going to be maybe 6-2 in conference, maybe 7-1 at best.
You can't possibly need me to add anything more on this game.
Fair enough. We're moving on to Rowan at Frostburg State. Rowan coming in at 3-0. That week one win against Widener looking a little less impressive than it did at the time. Frostburg State, as we know, is just eager to get back on the field. Last week's game was canceled because of Hurricane Florence. They were scheduled to play Christopher Newport, and that game will not be made up. Frostburg had 2 3-point wins and a 7-point win last year in NJAC play, but the Rowan game wasn't one of them.
How about Central at Dubuque? The Dutch are 3-0, perhaps resembling the Central of old. The Spartans have 2 solid road wins since they took it on the chin against UW-Whitewater in week one, and this game will help us make sense of the results in the Midwest to date. It was a week 11 game last year, and it's late September this time. Both Sean Duffy and Blaine Hawkins give each team an efficient passer. Right now, though, the guy to watch is Central strong safety Jordy Borman, who has 4 interceptions and a block punt return for a touchdown so far.
Yep, and the ARC, the American Rivers Conference, very winnable. Wartburg showed themselves to be a little bit vulnerable with their loss against Monmouth in week 2. My last game of this six-pack of games to watch is Millikan at Wheaton. I've been riding for Millikan a little bit this season. They were in the top 45 or so in our preseason ranking and kickoff, but I think the Big Blue are going to have their hands full with this one. Millikan won a close game at home last year when these teams met, and it will be a lot different for them on the road. This is the kind of game that will separate the top echelon in the CCIW from the rest of the teams who are expected to finish in the top half of the standings. And Keith, it's time to put each other on the spot. So if I remember last week, I won the toss and deferred. You're going to make this a running joke the whole way through. I have a quarter. You want to call it in the air?
Sure. I'm always tails.
All right. Tails never fails, right? That's what I've been told. I've got a quarter here. You can see it's a standard American quarter with George Washington on the back. It's a 1992 quarter, so there's nothing fancy on it. Keith, Tails, you want to go first or you want to defer?
Yeah, I'll kick off. That means I go first, right? I don't even know what it means.
Sure, right, I think look. So. You want to play defense, so you want to ask the question.
All right, here we go. 18 top 25 games this week, or 18 games involving top 25 teams. We've previously mentioned in the podcast, not the most compelling set of games as we look at them. How many of them finish within a 10-point margin? 10 points or fewer are decided by. I did a little research for you because I wanted you to not have to count this out while you're on the air. Approximately six of these games are matching winning teams, or at least teams we thought would be good this year. So take a quick look at that top 25. You tell me how many of them are decided by 10 points or less.
10 points or less. That was something I was going to have to clarify, whether it was less than 10 or 10 points or less. I think that as I'm looking at this group, I would say that I'm going down a long way before I even get to the first one. Maybe I will, just for the sake of making things interesting, I'll say that the John Carroll Mount Union game is going to be one of those. Barry and Center, I think, is a potential for a 10-point game. I think Buff State and RPI. Of course, I picked RPI to lose last week. I was this close to coming up with the correct answer. And I think Susquehanna and Franklin and Marshall, I don't think that Milliken and Wheaton are within this margin. Is it really just three games out of this group?
Yeah, like I said, I had you in it. Six was like the over-under. Yeah, I like Susquehanna, Franklin, Marshall. I think you could do either of the CCIW games if you believe in Milliken Wheaton or Illinois Wesley and Augustana. The Barry Center game looks good. And then you'll always get one weird one. I don't think that Frostburg State rowing game is going to be close.
No,
put me down for that one.
I don't think so either. If I go back and recount, though, I think I wanted to take Franklin and Marshall. I wanted to take RPI. I wanted to take Center. And I wanted to take the John Carroll Mount Union game. So that would actually be four.
And you guys feel free to play along at home.
Yeah.
How many top 25 games you think were are 10 points or fewer? You can tweet at us. You got until kickoff on Saturday.
Maybe we'll put that in the poll on the front page too.
All right.
Now that I've said that, I'm committed to it. Okay, Keith, on the spot. Which teams in the Heartland Collegiate Athletic Conference will win football games on Saturday? Well, we've got, and here's the games that we've got. We've got Anderson at Defiance. We've got Hanover at Bluffton. We've got Manchester at Rose-Hulman, and we've got Mount St. Joseph at Earlham. So I figure we've got one pretty solid, easy pick, and the rest of them are what I feel like teams fairly evenly matched in their various echelons of the conference. Franklin is off this week.
Yes, that's big. Taking Franklin out of the mix, I think.
Makes this a little more complicated, right?
Right. Defiance has really, really struggled so far. We've talked about it a couple times on the podcast. Coach didn't take over till the end of July. Didn't know a soul in the program. And I think the results have showed that. So I'll take Anderson in that one. Hanover, Bluffton. I thought Hanover looked decent in week two. So I'm going to go Hanover on that one. Mount St. Joseph's scoring like crazy. Earlham hasn't won in 45 games, so we'll go Mount St. Joseph there. Manchester Rose-Hulman is the one that's a little bit interesting, and it's the 7 p.m. night game because Manchester's been on the rise lately. Rose-Hulman struggled a little bit so far this season, but I'll go RHITL.
All right, so you've picked Anderson, Bluffton, Mount St. Joseph, and Rose-Hulman, RHIT.
I took Hanover, I think.
Yeah, look at that. Appreciate you calling me on that. That's fair. We should definitely at least jot it down correctly. We wouldn't have to go back to the audio tape just to score this next week. Speaking of scoring, last week, Keith said Mount Union would win by 21 and then later said by 21 to 28 points against Baldwin Wallace. Final score was
56-21, so it was 35. I was close but wrong.
I was wrong also, and not very close. I said that Springfield would rush for 420 yards against Union. Even if Chad Shade had stayed in the game for the entire game at quarterback, they were not going to approach 420. What was the actual number?
It was like 163. You mentioned it in the Monday pod, but you mentioned it with the caveat that there was a bad punt snap that took like 37 yards away.
Yeah, good point. Not that that would have made much of a difference, but I think that it is a little weird that 37 yards on a bad snap comes off of rushing yards or any team's total offense. Then again, we keep stats a little bit differently in college football than they do in the NFL, that's for sure. Time for the random game. The roulette wheel is spinning, and we'll pick one game out of 95. Random number generator comes up with 18. All right, 18 is pretty high on the list, so we may end up getting a game that we've already talked about. So close, Keith, we get 25th-ranked Ithaca at St. John Fisher, a game which was fantastic in 2002 and fantastic many other times since. This year, I'm not so sure that we'll get the same result.
Well, the real oddity here is St. John Fisher opened up against Washington Jefferson back in week one, and that's September 1st, 37-12 loss. And then they had two bye weeks. They didn't play on the 8th or the 15th, and now they got Ithaca, Brockport next week, Utica. So they're really looking at a tough start here, and you've got to, if you're St. John Fisher, you'd like to get a good result here against Ithaca, which has looked fairly strong, even though it's only 2-1.
If you're Ithaca and you're Coach Dan Swanstrom, you got to be pretty frustrated that you just have one tape of this year's games to work with.
On the flip side, we keep saying that thing where, you know, the teams that are two games in, the biggest improvement, what did the coaches always say, the biggest improvement is between game one and game two.
Yeah.
You don't have the first game jitters. You've seen everything once. Well, Ithaca's got three games under its belt. St. John Fisher just has one. So in theory, game four against game two is some kind of advantage. But St. John Fisher also would be like just eager to play.
Yeah, and have 3 weeks to prep for Ithaca, if that makes a difference. I know that St. John Fisher at one point this season had a game against Malone, which is a Division II school scheduled for one of those weeks, but it did not end up coming off. Time for the one-liners. We got the incredible barnstorming Saints of Thomas More heading to Huntington. We've got Carthage at Wash U. We have Mount St. Joseph at Earlham. We have Albright at Widener, Barry at Center, and Susquehanna at Franklin and Marshall.
I'm just as interested in Huntington as I am Thomas More's barnstorming, because the Hawks are looking for their second official result and first win after Guilford was called off because of lightning in week one. They lost to Birmingham Southern in week two, and they had a bye in week three. So this was a team I actually thought was a top 25 team at one point, Huntington, and just haven't seen them play much.
That Birmingham Southern loss, totally unexpected.
Carthage at Wash U, still strange to think of that as a CCIW game. Earlham, we mentioned the 45-game losing streak. We believe last week that became the second longest in D3 history. Albright at Widener. These are two teams, great history. We thought they'd be pretty good. They're both winless at this point and in tough situations. We found out that before the game, Mike Kelly suspended 8 guys for the first half last week for showing up late to meetings. But he did say his players played hard, which he'd discussed coaching effort.
Yeah.
And I'm blaming Google.
Barry at center. The Colonels missed the playoffs at 9-1 last season. Both are 3-0 now, so Barry is the only team that's beaten them since the first day of October back in 2016 when they lost to Hendricks. You think center really wants to beat Barry? I think so.
Yeah.
They're at home, and this is their big opportunity to get some national recognition. For Susquehanna at F&M, Susquehanna's been the – 2 weeks ago, they were the surprise team of the Centennial by beating perennial power Johns Hopkins. Then they turn around, lost on a late kick against Muhlenberg. But for F&M, for the Diplomats, this is the first of a brutal 3-game stretch. They play Susquehanna, then Muhlenberg, then Johns Hopkins. So we'll get a pretty clear picture of what the Centennial looks like over the next few weeks.
We talked with John Troxell back in May. I think that was the May podcast or maybe the April podcast. It was a good interview. I definitely go back and listen to it about how they're trying to build that program up. And of course, they moved into a brand new stadium at the end of last season. This is their first full year in that really, really nice Division III stadium. We have to score quick hits. That's the other thing we do on this podcast. Looking back at last week, we had 4 games that were put forward as the game of the week, but it was Adam Turr's pick, number 18, Barry at Rhodes, which was the closest of those down the stretch. Frank Rossi and our guest prognosticator, John McGraw, each picked top 25 teams that got upset. Frank had Union over Springfield. John had Thomas More over UW-Platteville. Adam took Barry, which was a good game, but not good enough for Rhodes. I took RPI, and I spent a lot of time watching overtimes before the Engineers held on to win that game. And Keith, you and Ryan Tipps picked?
Frostburg State, of course. We made the joke that they would be upset for not having their game played and not necessarily get upset.
I have no problem with jokes in the quick hits. I'm perfectly willing to do that sort of thing myself. We'd asked our panel to pick a home team to win a NESCAC game on NESCAC's opening weekend. There were really only 2 reasonable choices to make, and from those, Keith, Adam, and Frank each picked Wesleyan, which rolled over Middlebury 52-21. Those of us who picked Hamilton, well, Hamilton scored on a safety, and that was about it. The final score of the Willamette Occidental game was Willamette 25-6, which most closely resembles John McGraw's 24-10 projection. Only Frank picks Occidental as a winner in that one.
And if you folks aren't entirely clear what Quick Hits is, it's our Friday morning look ahead at the slate of games in D3. We're doing it here on the podcast. So if when you see that tomorrow morning, if you've listened to the podcast already, you'll have an idea of what's going on. But this gives you six looks at, quick hits, obviously, at what's happening across the country. And, we got to hold ourselves accountable for our picks.
Holding us accountable, huh? We got one more thing before we go. I mentioned on this podcast over the summer that I was in a battle, I guess, with my running habit and whatever passes for training for me. And I am completely off the track here in September. I've previously tapped into the Division III head coaching knowledge base for help and inspiration when I'm looking for it. And I went to Dan Garrett for some stuff on this. I assume that you probably know that your running app automatically tweets every time you go for a run. I have been running for the last couple of summers, and this year I've really kind of fallen off the wagon. I need a little bit of a pep talk. Tell me something that's going to get me back out there and running again.
Well, I do know that. Let me tell you why. There's two reasons why I do that. You know, some people tweet out their workouts for an egomaniac thing. I do it to hold myself accountable and responsible for my runs, because when I 5 years ago when I started this running thing, in the football life, as a lot of coaches know, you can get in a real bad rut. And I started eating bad and didn't exercise bad. I got up to 320 pounds. And I started this journey 5 years ago, and I vowed that once I got the weight off, I would never go back. And as I was doing that journey daily, whether it was a one-mile run or two-mile runs, I made sure I held myself accountable by tweeting that. So now after 5 years, when I don't run for a day or two, someone's going to tweet at me or DM me and say, hey, coach, how come you've been running? So I do that to hold myself accountable. There is more days, Pat, that I do not feel like running for anything. Yeah. But my thing to you is, when you have a big enough why, you'll find the how. And my big enough why is, I don't want to be 320 pounds again. I don't want to feel like that again. So if you can find the why, you'll always find the how. And it's really that first step, because and as I'm running, there's probably 50, 60, 100 times that I want to stop. And as I'm running, I just tell myself, sometimes it's out loud and my guys look at me on the treadmill or on the track, the people look at me and I say, I can, I will. And I tell myself to shut up. So there's 1,000 negative voices going on in our head. You just got to find the one reason, the one voice that's telling you why you have to do something, as opposed to listen to all the voices why they tell you not to.
Now, I'm not asking D3 fans to hold me accountable. Please don't tweet at me when I don't run, but you can find my slow plodding attempts at what's called running on the Strava app. I was a baseball player. We run about 300 feet at a time. This is what I'm saying. When I run, it's me remembering that life is short and maybe I can make it last a little longer by being more healthy. My weight to avoid is 235 rather than the 320 that Coach Garrett was talking about. But either way, I run in a Wesley Football NJAX Champs shirt as a reminder of just how quickly health can get away from me.
No, that's deep. I was just saying to my daughter on Wednesday night that every piece of health advice she'll get her entire life boils down to one of three things: eat healthy, exercise, get your sleep. I was doing it to nudge her to get to bed since it was a school night, but I'm hearing you guys, I'm hearing my dad voice, and knowing I need to get my self in gear too.
I wonder where mental health fits into that.
Was I supposed to react? That was a good point.
I don't know.
It was a good point, actually.
Do you want to react to that?
I don't know what to say.
And this was D3Football.com Around the Nation podcast number 205, released on September 21st of 2018. Thanks for listening, and tune into the rest of our coverage throughout the weekend. If you like this podcast, please consider rating it in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or anywhere else that you get podcasts. That will help other Division III football fans find it. You can leave comments for us on the blog page, or you can contact us in things that we're going to talk about here in just a second. But before I get to that, the executive producer of the D3Football.com Around the Nation podcast is Pat Coleman. Production assistance provided by Dave McHugh. Our theme music is by DJ Mentos, whom you can find at djmentos.com. Thanks to our contributors, Adam Turr and Frank Rossi, and thanks to our guest, Dan Garrett, and Sports Information Director Kim DeRitter for their time and assistance on this edition of our show. Also, of course, thanks to the creator of Around the Nation on D3Football.com and my co-host, Keith McMillan. You can reach us to talk more about Division III football on Twitter using the D3FB hashtag. I'm at D3Football on Twitter, and Keith is at D3Keith. We have a message board devoted to Division III sports. Did you know? Join the conversation by registering a post at d3boards.com. Also, you can follow d3football.com on Facebook.
Thank you so much, everybody.